Hey everyone, Jordan here from Barbell Medicine. Now, we'll get to the podcast here in just a moment, but I wanted to take a second to plug our Barbell Medicine Plus option in order to help support what we do here on the podcast and beyond. Now, if you hate these ads just as much as we do, you should know that Plus members get ad-free episodes, as well as early access to our podcast, written episode summaries, videos, exclusive training information, access to a members-only podcast where Dr. Baraki and I answer your questions directly, and more exclusive content as well. If you want to support what we're doing here and become a Barbell Medicine Plus member, head over to barbellmedicine.com/plus and sign up to be a Plus member today. That's barbellmedicine.com/plus to help us out and get rid of these ads for good. Thanks for your support. Let's head to the podcast.
Hey, football fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win up to $250,000 in bonus bets. It's all part of BetMGM's longest touchdown jackpot, where you'll be able to split the grand prize with anyone else who bet on the longest touchdown of the week. Log into your BetMGM account today and opt into the promo. Then, place an anytime touchdown wager of $10 or more on the player of your choice up to one player per game. If your player scores the longest touchdown of the week, you'll win a share of the $250,000. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This U.S. promotional offer is not available in Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. For New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369. For Arizona, 1-800-NEXT-STEP. For Massachusetts, 1-800-327-5050. For Iowa, 1-800-BETS-OFF. For Puerto Rico, 1-800-981-0023. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are unrestricted bonus dollars that expire in 7 days. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, and this is Great Debates in Fitness and in Health, Episode 10. You know, Dr. Baraki, this is the first one we've done in many months, and I know you've been missing it. Like, you're just not fulfilled unless we are in conflict. And so I just, it's a new year and I wanted to start this year off on the right foot. So, you know, let's beef, let's battle.
We'll do our best, I guess.
That is the second most handsome doctor in North America, Dr. Austin Baraki. And you may be wondering, like, why this format? Why are we debating? Especially if we actually agree on most things. Well, maybe we'll find some points of contention here. That's thing one. Thing two is that if you are truly an expert in the subject matter, you tend to know where people would push back or disagree, and you can sort of handle those concerns. And so I think not only is this entertaining in a way that we flex and mobilize ourselves into various contorted positions to stay, you know, sort of sane, but also, you know, maybe we can provide a more full picture on contentious topics. So the format here is going to be 5 minutes per question, maybe a little bit longer. We really don't stick to that. It's a loose program. And the person who goes first has to pick affirmative or negative. So are they in support of the premise or not? And then the other person gets to rebut them for another 2 minutes. And then the person who led off gets to respond. That's what we're going to do. And again, it's a loose program. Don't set your clocks or watches to this. It's just not going to work. We did get an interesting question from our Supercast, one of our Supercast subscribers. And they said, the Great Debates segments never quite landed for me because it is clear that you guys pretty much agree on the correct position and you would often try to finesse your way out through creatively defining the terms of the debate. As a former debate team member, I approve. What are some things that you guys actually disagree on? And then he actually said, hey, sorry if this leads to the end of Barbell Medicine. So we will be publishing our response to that particular question to our Barbell Medicine Plus subscribers. You can subscribe too if you go to barbellmedicine.supercast.com. And there's a whole bunch of value adds for people who do subscribe to the Barbell Medicine Plus membership. So one, you get new templates ahead of publication. We've got 20 templates coming out in 2025. I just finished two of them. So we got a time crunch template. That update, there's actually six separate templates that come in that download that'll be released this month, but our Supercast subscribers are going to get early access to a few weeks of those, and also the Strength One sort of update. And they get summaries and graphs and charts and special episodes, including these Ask Me Anythings, teaching rounds, and more. Also, by the way, no ads. So if you don't like the ads, well, for the cost of two coffees a month, you can hear Barbell Medicine. You don't have to hear me read, you know, these little ad reads that we do to support what we do here, and also just everything else that we do with Barbell Medicine. So That's the ad read for the Barbell Medicine Supercast thing. Again, if this leads to the end of Barbell Medicine as we know it, I blame this person who submitted that particular question. All right, let's get into this. And I think, you know, as the reigning champion of great debates, I'm 9-0 by my own estimation.
Sure. Yeah, fine.
Sure. I'm going to let you lead off on this first premise, okay? So we're going to start here with the first sort of great debate in fitness and in health, this is episode 10. This one is on dietary supplements, and this is from an article you sent me earlier today, so this is very topical and timely. Approximately 75% of Americans report taking dietary supplements in the previous year, which contributes to an over $35 billion a year supplement market. Now, in the United States, dietary supplements are classified as food and are therefore not subject to pre-market testing by the FDA. Now, they're still regulated by the FDA, but this is post-market surveillance, so once they're already on the market. The FDA is involved in some pre-market regulation by establishing these good manufacturing practices. That's GMP. You guys hear me talk about making sure that your supplements are GMP accredited. And this is in an effort to limit supplement contamination, verify the accuracy of the supplement's labeling, and set standards for monitoring and reporting adverse events associated with supplement use. That said, not every company adheres to GMP policies. A 2013 FDA report showed that approximately 70% of supplement manufacturers were in violation of GMPs, and additionally, 28% failed to even register with the FDA. Overall, probably about 20% of all dietary supplements available for purchase are likely contaminated, and close to half are mislabeled, though these are probably underestimates due to lack of reporting, resources, and so on. A new report by the Clean Label Project, they do some third-party testing, well, they found out that of the 160 products from 70 of the top-selling brands, that all represents about 83% of the supplement market, well, nearly half of them exceeded at least one federal or state guideline for contamination, which leads me to the premise, which you'll lead on this, Dr. Baraki. The premise is the use of dietary supplements is more risky than any potential benefit. What do you say to that?
Yeah, so I'll just take it at face value that this is obviously a very broad premise in terms of it just saying dietary supplements as one gigantic bucket without specifying any particular supplement, be it creatine or whey protein or anything else outside of those two, and then just risk versus potential benefit. So at that face value, I'm inclined to agree with this. I would just say essentially, like, if I'm to pick almost at random a dietary supplement and then to estimate the potential risk or potential downsides to include things like physical toxicity, adverse effects from it, or what we call in medicine sometimes financial toxicity, meaning you're paying cost for something that is not delivering that value, compared with the potential benefit, I think that in general, on average, for most dietary supplements, you're likely to end up on the negative side of that equation. And the way that I'm coming to this is just recognizing that the vast majority of dietary supplements don't do much, if anything. Some of them actually cause harm, of course. All of them cost some amount of money and time and effort to take. And so when faced with not only that direct trade-off, but then also adding in this additional layer of contamination risk, which is very high in this industry, I think that further tilts the balance away from it. I have, you know, you cited some compelling statistics with a side project that I did recently that I'm sure we'll be announcing soon related to testosterone supplements. I also took a look at some data in that space because this is another commonly advertised area of testosterone booster supplements, for example. So one paper evaluated 50 different supplements marketed as quote unquote boosting testosterone. And these supplements contained on average about 8 supplements per product, 8 different compounds were advertised. Of all of the compounds in these supplements, about a quarter of them had any supporting data at all to show that they might increase testosterone. 10% showed that they tended to decrease testosterone. 20% had effectively no effect on testosterone, and about 60% had no data whatsoever on them. And flying blind in that way, in an you know, a minimally regulated or only post-market kind of industry like that, I think that you have to err on the side of the risk is likely greater than any potential benefit, especially when you add in the layer of potential contamination. This Clean Label Project, which prompted the news that I sent to you, they were finding high levels of various heavy metal contamination, things like cadmium and things like that, which not great for a lot of things. And part of the issue is that it takes years for enough of that type of thing to accumulate in your body before it manifests in symptoms. And those symptoms are sufficiently nonspecific that it might not flag on a doctor's radar. For example, there are like neuropsychiatric symptoms, for example, that you can get from cadmium toxicity, but neurologic and psychiatric conditions are so common in general that a lot of people aren't going to think to maybe I should check your cadmium levels to see if that's what's causing this. Maybe you just have this psychiatric issue as a primary disorder. So it can make it even harder to diagnose, and then that can lead to downstream morbidity and things like that. So to summarize, I think that most dietary supplements do little or nothing. Some cause overt harm. Many are contaminated. And so taking this broad bucket of dietary supplements in general, I think that if you're like, should I take a supplement or not? I think you're more likely to do well if you say no than you are to be your life to be radically improved if you say yes.
Yeah, these are some compelling points. And I will concede to you that I agree most dietary supplements don't do much. Based on available evidence. There are some exceptions, but generally speaking, even the ones that do work aren't like life-changing, right? There is some cost associated with all supplements. As far as I know, no supplement company in business today is giving out free supplements to folks in perpetuity. And there's some associated risk due to the relatively high rates of contamination, mislabeling, and even misuse. You know, you could attribute that to maybe lack of specific directions or something like that. However, my pushback here on the risk, at least apparent risk, with the caveat being we probably don't know all of the apparent risk just due to underreporting, difficulty sort of ascertaining why somebody has specific symptoms, as you alluded to with the cadmium toxicity. People wouldn't be looking for that, for example. A lot of people take supplements. 75% of Americans have taken supplements for the past year, and that's probably an underestimate. Yet, we do not see this overwhelming sort of influx of sick people in the emergency rooms, in primary care clinics, and whatever. So to me, it seems like, yeah, you know, we know that there is likely some risk, some cost, and they probably don't do much, yet people still find ways to do fine. And it may just be that the majority of people using supplements are relatively young or otherwise healthy or maybe more health conscious individuals, for example. Although you could make the argument that, look, if someone is searching for a supplement, maybe they're searching for an answer to a problem. And so maybe they aren't actually that healthy. This is more speculation. However, what we do know is that while there are real cases of severe injury secondary to supplements, you know, there's a whole registry of like the liver induced injury and such. It's not overwhelming. And given the amount of use, it seems hard to argue that this risk is just way out of proportion to the typical use of current supplements. And you know the data as well as I do about how well people like will adhere to taking, you know, multiple medications, for example, or a single medication. And I would suspect the same is likely true for supplements. So what I suspect is that the biggest risk is probably cost. For the majority of supplements, even though I don't think that most of them are like, you know, this is safe, 10 out of 10 would recommend. I think they all cost, there's some risk, yet people still find a way to do fine. And so I, you know, if forced to push back, I would say I agree with almost everything that you said, except for the outcomes that we have with respect to risk do not paint this picture of like, man, if you take a supplement, this is real risk. I would also say, just again, speaking out of both sides of my mouth, I don't recommend that people should just take supplements, particularly in like the two sort of industries. One would be like sexual enhancement. The other one would be testosterone boosting. Those tend to be the most commonly like contaminated and mislabeled sort of areas. You could add fat loss as a third one in there. If you avoided those three sort of genres of supplements, I feel like you probably eliminate a substantial amount of risk, but not all risk, especially depending on who you follow on social media and what they're selling. But yeah, where are the bodies? You know, that's kind of my to summarize.
Yeah, I have to check my like patient selection bias or population bias, because who sees all the worst outcomes from supplements? Who sees the acute liver failure, the acute kidney failure, the, you know, neurologic, you know, consequences, whatever? That's me, because I'm the one who admits people like that to the hospital. I've sent plenty of people for, you know, to ICUs for liver transplantation due to, you know, various contaminated peri-workout supplements and things like that over the years. And I am deliberately setting that aside, recognizing that that is like a very salient thing in my mind. mind, but agreeing that by and large, you know, given how common supplement use is, yeah, the bodies are not necessarily piling up. And so I think, you know, in my original kind of response to this, that's kind of why I lumped in both. There is the physical side, which can have the more dramatic presentations that I'm talking about, or can have the more subtle presentations that may go unrecognized or maybe very difficult to recognize, like, you know, subtle progressive like lead toxicity that takes years to like decades to accumulate if you take something very, you know, over long periods of time, or like gradually progressive chronic kidney disease as something that emerged many years back in the context of a particular weight loss clinic. And that was how we identified a very particular like kidney related toxin that was, you know, found in this weight loss supplement. So these things that can be challenging to identify, but then also lumping in what I called the financial toxicity. If a supplement is giving you no concrete benefit, certainly not like life-changing benefits, and yet you're spending money on it, then I view that as a net negative or a downside. But so yeah, I wouldn't paint with so broad a brush to say like dietary supplements are like catastrophic by and large. But I think that if it's just like, which way does the seesaw tilt on balance, all downsides, all upsides, population wide, I think I'm inclined to say it's a slight tilt towards the negative. Some of these cases are much more dramatically negative, like the kind that give you acute liver failure, and you're lucky if you get a fresh liver as a result of it. Some are slightly positive, like creatine, or if you, for example, if you've had metabolic bariatric surgery and you need to be on, you know, a replacement, you know, supplemental multivitamin, multimineral for the rest of your life. Yeah, that's super, super important for you. So that's like a subpopulation that gets a bunch of benefit, assuming a non-contaminated source. But just like as broadly speaking as we can, dietary supplements in general, I think it probably tilts ever so slightly in the negative, which is as strong of a take as I'm willing to provide on this topic when speaking that broadly.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what happens in the next decade, two decades, because there's a whole generation of people who effectively have been raised, quote unquote, on supplements. At least supplements have been normalized to a way where they probably have been consuming supplements for a long period of time. And so if there is this sort of like exposure risk, you know, that accumulates over time, we're going to see that later on. And, you know, perhaps we'll look back on this episode whenever it goes up and be like, man, we should have hammered the risks more. So if you're out there and you're like, look, I want to use dietary supplements because I want to get all of the potential benefits of exercise. I want to maximize them. I want the max performance, which is probably the best use case for supplements for an otherwise healthy individual. I don't know that there are, I don't think that there are a lot of health benefits for otherwise healthy people from taking dietary supplements. You can make a case for maybe like a protein supplement if somebody needs that. But otherwise, if you don't have a medical condition that requires a supplement, like you alluded to, I don't think most people should take supplements for health. For performance, my sort of guidelines are, well, make sure that they are accredited by CGMP, so they follow good manufacturing practices, they're registered with the FDA, and that they're third-party tested. So NSF, USP, we used Inform for Sport. There are a number of third-party testing organizations out there. And it's interesting, I had a client and she messaged me. She was trying to find a particular type of a vegan protein supplement. We don't sell ours anymore. The market just wasn't there, so we don't have ours. But they were like, look, is this a good supplement? And I looked all over the label or whatever, and there's no sort of mark for a third-party testing. So I was like, hey, just ask them. It is possible that they're third-party tested and they just haven't updated their label, for example. It's not likely, but it is possible, because generally speaking, like for us, for example, we cut probably a quarter of our margin at a minimum on all of the supplements that we sell by making sure every batch that we put out into the market has been third-party tested. And so, yeah, it eats into our margins. It costs a decent amount of money. And they wouldn't answer the question. They were like, well, look, our production line is free from contaminated substances, so athletes can use our stuff. It's like, well, how do you know? If you're not testing every batch, how could you possibly know? And so just make sure it's third-party tested, GMP. It should be on the label, again, because you pay a bunch of money to do this sort of stuff. So it seems unlikely that you wouldn't have that called out on the label somewhere. Although if you want to know, just ask. And usually most of these third-party testing companies will have this sort of registry. Like, hey, who's paying the fee to be registered with us yearly and making sure that every batch is tested? That'd be the sort of bare minimum for using supplements. And then the second part would be, make sure you're taking a supplement that has good evidence of benefit. right, for whatever you're trying to do, and you're taking it in the correct way. So that's the dosing, when you, if there's a time related thing to take it at a specific time. So yeah, that's my spiel on supplements. Pretty scary stuff out there. I mean, you know, people are like, well, look, can't I go to Costco and just pick up this whey? And I'm like, well, is it third party tested? Is it, you know, GMP accredited? And they're like, I can't tell. It's not on the label. I'm like, I don't think it's worth saving the, you know, few bucks compared to, you know, taking something like ours or another brand out there that is third-party tested and GMP accredited. I don't think it's worth a few dollars to get, you know, that supplement while you're picking up your 2-pound jar of peanut butter.
Yeah. I mean, again, with my selection bias in mind, having seen like the worst possible outcomes that can happen from these kind of things, although relatively rare, not something I would prefer to gamble with if it were me.
You take supplements?
Just whey and creatine. Yeah.
Just whey. Yeah. Same. I take our whey RX, and then I take our Peri RX supplement, and that's pretty much it. And people are like, well, no multivitamin. I'm like, I mean, it is highly unlikely that I'm deficient in any particular micronutrient. I have a varied diet. I don't have any sort of medical condition that would cause me to be deficient. I have no symptoms associated with any known vitamin deficiencies. So no multivitamin for me. Like, oh, what about fish oil? I'm like, I eat fish, you know,
yeah, same.
Once a week usually. So like, the fish oil, if anything, would cause an increase in risk potentially for AFib or and some other stuff. And I don't necessarily want that. Plus, I couldn't be bothered with taking the pills. Yeah. So, all right, let's go on to the second question in Great Debates in Fitness and Health, episode 10. We're going to talk about sumo deadlifts again. Another favorite topic. Well, so look, I searched all the previous Great Debates that we did, and we did address sumo deadlifts once, and it was about, you know, is it better for strength or worse for strength compared to conventional deadlifts? And we're going to do a little twist on this.
Okay.
The origins of the sumo deadlift are murky, but many credit the lightweight Japanese lifter Hideki Inaba with introducing it to powerlifting. In 1974, Hideki Inaba deadlifted 485, which was over four times his 114-pound body weight, though he used a modified sumo stance where his arms started between his legs, like a typical sumo deadlift, but they finished with his arms outside of his legs, so kind of like a little hybrid. The American Mike Bridges was also a pioneer of the sumo deadlift, pulling 660 pounds at a body weight of 165 pounds at the IPF World Championships. IPF is the International Powerlifting Federation. He did that in 1979. Regardless of who popularized or, quote, invented the sumo deadlift, the sport of powerlifting accepted this deadlift variation with open arms, while most other barbell sports rejected it. For example, both strongman and CrossFit prohibit pulling sumo in any deadlift event. Olympic weightlifting doesn't actually have any rules against using a sumo stance, only other technical rules regarding the two competitive movements. That's the snatch and the clean and jerk. So theoretically, you could do a snatch pulling sumo or
that'd be clean awesome. And jerk.
I tried. Is there anybody out there who did, you know, a clean and jerk by pulling sumo? Yeah. And I couldn't find any. There's got to be at least some person out there who did it. I just couldn't find a video of it or a high profile person. Interestingly, the IPF, again, the International Powerlifting Federation, they were rumored to be discussing some additional rules for sumo deadlifts in competition, similar to how they revised their bench press rules, where your elbows had to go below, you know, the shoulder joint, for example, to constitute a legal rep. Well, there was some discussion, are they going to have a max stance width? Are they going to have a minimum grip width? But there's been no real developments on that front. So you can still do sumo deadlifts by any means, as long as the bar keeps moving during the deadlift. You don't hitch it, for example, or ramp it, and you don't drop it. So the premise, and I'll lead on this, sumo deadlifts are, quote, cheating in powerlifting and in non-competitive training, where cheating means there's an unfair advantage compared to conventional deadlifting, as it avoids the harder work of a conventional deadlift. I'm going to take the affirmative here in a surprise to you, okay? Because I think this will be some interesting fodder, right? The way I think about sumo deadlifts as compared to conventional deadlifts is a completely different strategy to lift the weight. Okay. Now, while it is allowed currently in the rules, so it's not technically cheating by the letter of the law, in this case, the law being the IPF, it's just a different exercise, right? And so the idea that they should be compared together under one sport, granted, sports are just collections of arbitrarily made up rules. So I'm conceding that point. but to me, they just seem like different exercises. I don't think that sumo is technically easier to do than a conventional. It's just different. And so when you compare lifters of similar body weights, presumably of similar stature, right? If they're in the same weight class, there's, you know, range, of course, but it's just a different exercise. And so does that mean that the policy should change where we should have like a powerlifting division that's got a sumo division versus a conventional division? I'm not making any policy suggestions. I'm just saying I don't know how to compare, for example, Hideki Inaba's, you know, nearly 500 pound deadlift to a person in his weight class also deadlifting about 500 conventionally. They're just different things, but yet we still do compare them. We are literally comparing apples. It's probably not to oranges, but maybe some other sort of variation of an apple. So it you know, cheating is a strong word, and I probably could have come up with some better language for that. But I just think they're two different exercises, and you could use the sumo deadlift to train a particular type of adaptation that you're searching for. I just don't really know how to compare them outside of these arbitrarily designed rules. And yeah, sure, that's sports. I'll concede that, you know, just all made up. But when comparing a conventional deadlift to a sumo deadlift, I just think they're different. And so when you do have to compare them, it seems to me that the sumo deadlift is distinctly different and should probably not be compared on an equal playing field. What say you?
Okay. I guess if I'm taking the negative here and saying that it's not cheating, I'm going to invoke some things from other sports. There are various other sports where the objective or the task being tested, the way it's contested in sport can be examined in one of two ways. It can either be examined in terms of an outcome. Was the outcome achieved? Or it is a very particular skill that is being assessed as it is performed in a particular way. So this is a nebulous, hand-wavy way of saying the following. You are going to contest the high jump. Are you going to run and jump over the high jump facing forward? Or are you going to be Dick Fosbury and figure out that you can flip around and go over it backwards? Meaning, is the method that you achieved, the skill of performing it in that way, the task that is being tested and compared between people? Or is it the final objective that is being determined? Who jumped over the highest bar anyhow? I think of the same thing in swimming, for example, my own sporting background, where there's actually there's examples of both. There are obviously the four or the defined strokes that are contested, butterfly, backstroke, breaststroke, which when you contest an event in fly, back, or breast, you have to execute the race using that very particular technique. In a freestyle race, you can use any stroke you want, even though most people, when you watch a quote-unquote freestyle race, you see them perform the front crawl, because for most people, they tend to be fastest at that. Interestingly, I think it was this past year's NCAA championships, there was an athlete who contested their freestyle race doing butterfly because they happened to be faster at that. And so they were able to race. It might have been the 50 free or some or part of a relay where they contested it doing fly. And so out of the entire pool, seven lanes of people doing front crawl, and this one person who was hanging with the best of them was doing butterfly. And so you could view that as a sumo deadlifter in a sea of conventional deadlifters or vice versa. And you can say, hey, is that person cheating? Well, in that particular defined event, a freestyle event, the question is who gets to the wall first? Don't care how, right? The only rules around that is, like, of course, how long can you how much time can you spend underwater, et cetera, et cetera. But just like who gets their hand on the wall first versus if it was a dedicated backstroke event, yet you're going to be on your back, right? You have to. So that's kind of how I'm thinking about this question. In powerlifting, it's not clear to me, you know, when we talk about this competitive event in the sport of a deadlift, is the event who picked up the most weight anyhow, or is it, you know, which would need to be defined more clearly, who can pick up the most weight with their arms outside their legs, for example, which would need to be more explicitly defined. And so I think the reason why this is contentious, why this is difficult, is that it's not clear in the way this sport is defined, this event is defined. Is this an outcome event of, you know, is it just called the pickup event and you have a weight in front of you and you just pick it up. I don't care. Like, could you do a Jefferson deadlift or any, like, could you stand across the bar and pick it up with it in between your legs and lock it out just under your crotch? Like, people do that as a lift in training. Could you do that and lock it out and it be a successful lift? Or does it have to be done in this defined way, like the defined strokes or like many other sports that are contested where there's a clearly defined, you know, method that must be executed in order for it to be considered legal? If that was just distilled, then this whole argument could just go away. And so for now, you know, insofar as it is not defined, I will choose to interpret it as it's the pickup event. Pick it up, you know, in which case, you know, who picked up the most weight between sumo and conventional? I don't really care. It's a pickup. You know, one person picked up more than the other. I don't really care how they did it. But once, as soon as that is more clearly defined, then suddenly, you know, you're invoking, yeah, the arbitrary rules of sport, and it needs to be done in a particular way.
Yeah. Yeah. To me, it's kind of like a gamesmanship problem, right? It's using a questionable method to gain advantage for the individual based on their anthropometry, their leverages, their stuff, whatever, without actually violating the rules. It's within the rules, but you couldn't do, for example, like you can't stand across the bar, right? Where you're doing a split sort of deadlift. You can't deadlift it with the weight behind your back. So they've made some sort of rules around, well, you can't do this, but anything else goes. And I have no problem with that for a sport. I just feel like, again, sumo versus conventional, it's just difficult to compare performances on both. And if, you know, you really want to know who's the strongest person, you would prefer to have maybe some more comparable type efforts. Now, in saying that, people are listening, like, Jordan, you really think sumo deadlift is cheating? Right. You really, and I'm like, look, man, for the person who does not compete in powerlifting, right, the thought that sumo is cheating with the idea it has less of a sort of training effect. You get less sort of, force production adaptation. You get less muscular hypertrophy, less, well, it's just easier. It's just different, right? Instead of having as much sort of loading on the low back, you're going to have more of that transferred to the hips, the adductors, for example, and you're still going to get stronger, which has to be tested in a specific context. But even if you were testing it with like an isokinetic sort of, you know, leg curl, and you took one group of people that just did conventional deadlifts and one group of people just did sumo deadlifts, I would predict they would do about the same, you know, at the end of the day, because neither of them are like awesome hamstring exercises compared to other variations that we potentially have. They're probably going to do about the same. Same thing for hypertrophy. Neither are great like hypertrophy exercises in isolation, but they still will stimulate some hypertrophy. I predict most people to do about the same, maybe different regional hypertrophy based on the loading. And so I don't think that it's like a worse variation. And I want to be clear about that. I don't think it's worse. I don't think sumo deadlifts are worse than conventional. I just think it's different. And if we're trying to do a sport that has this sort of definition, like you mentioned, like it's a breaststroke, it's a fly, it's a backstroke, you got to do it a certain way, because we just want to narrow the sort of constraints here. I don't know that powerlifting would be a better sport if they did that. It would just be easier to compare performances across weight classes, between individuals, and so on. Now, when you look at like the world record deadlifts, and you're like, well, are they more of them done sumo, more of them done conventional? It really depends how you slice the data, but there's not a clear winner here. You know, generally speaking, lighter weight classes, more the women's weight classes tend to see more sumo deadlifts, whereas the heavier weight classes seem to do more conventional. But, you know, there's variations all in between. I don't think it's worse. I just think it's different. And so why do people do it? Well, they think it confers some sort of advantage, and presumably some sort of competitive advantage that doesn't break the rules. So to me, it's the gamesmanship issue. And if you want to call that cheating, I think that's a dirty word and people take it's an adverse word. It insinuates that people have some nefarious intent. I don't think that's the case. I just think they're doing it within the construct of the rules right now.
Yeah. Another thing that it reminds me of is just like looking at all-time point scoring totals in basketball.
Yeah.
It doesn't tell you how they did it, right?
Yeah.
You get points by ball through hoop. And there was a time in basketball history when the dunk was banned, where you were not allowed to do it that way, right? Now, that ban has obviously since been revoked and people are allowed to dunk. But when you look at an all-time point scoring total, it is not immediately apparent to you. Were those points accumulated via dunks, via layups, via... you know, jump shots or 3-point shots or anything like that, right? It's just you're accomplishing the outcome via different ways. And obviously they're assigned point values and all that's just part of the made up aspect of sport. But that's another example of like, do we care how you did it or that you did it? And that's the fundamental issue at play here.
Yeah, the maybe interesting disconnect, and we'll get off this topic, that they care not how you did it, but that you did it in powerlifting. They do it. That's the only – that's like for the deadlift, that's a, it's effectively open market. Do whatever you want. But the bench press in the IPF, for example, well we do care how you did it. Same thing on the squat. We do care. You can't front squat it. Yeah, you know, and you got to make sure that your hands are in a certain position relative to your shoulder joint. There's some other technical rules. So yeah, it's an interesting sort of like inconsistency within the sport.
Yeah, it's too bad. I would love to go to a powerlifting meet and front squat, reverse grip bench, and Jefferson deadlift.
Yeah. Yeah. What's your best sumo deadlift, Austin? 765 with straps.
765 with straps, and pretty ugly, but yeah, that was that. Yeah.
And then let's try to make it a more equal comparison.
Probably I would say both conventional and my conventional sumo one rep max that are both right around 750, I would say clean.
Yeah. I can't sumo deadlift. I've done 660, so 300 kilos, and my best conventional deadlift 748. Would my sumo deadlift catch up to my conventional deadlift if I trained it? Maybe, but I don't feel particularly good doing it. And yeah. So maybe not. I don't know that I'd be able to train it as much to get to that level. So when people say, it's cheating, with the idea that, if I just pulled sumo, I'd deadlift more, just do it then. Yeah. If that's the case. It's the same thing with people talk about like bench press arches. If I had an arch that big, I'd bench 500. It's like, well, do it.
Yeah.
I promise you won't.
Yeah.
I promise you. And if you do happen to PR out of nowhere just by changing your technique to using a bigger arch or sumo, post it on Instagram and tag me, and then I'll send you $100. All right. So yeah, actually I'm going to not give you $100, but I will concede that, well, I was wrong on that one. I'm just afraid that a bunch of people who are untrained are just going to be $100. I'll take that bet.
There you go.
Let's
right.
go. Yeah. All right.
Hi, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, founder of Barbell Medicine. And over the last 10 plus years in business, we've built a team of amazing professionals that includes physicians, physical therapists, dietitians, and strength coaches that are available to help you reach your goals. Whether it's strength and muscle gain, weight management, or recovering from an injury, we have some of the best coaches in the game and have worked with people from all walks of life. From teens to grandparents and beginners to elite level athletes, our experienced team of professionals work together to meet you where you're at and give you what you need to succeed. That's the Barbell Medicine difference. If you're not sure exactly what you need, take the quiz linked in the description below or send us an email, support@barbellmedicine.com, and we'll get you sorted. From all of us here at Barbell Medicine, we look forward to hearing from you. We'd love to help. This podcast is brought to you by Rosetta Stone. 2025 is here, which probably means you're reflecting on what you hope to achieve and perhaps even considering some New Year's resolutions. Learning a new language in 2025 with Rosetta Stone is a great goal, which comes with the added benefits of exploring new cultures, connecting more deeply with others, and oh, by the way, it's 50% off for life. Now, Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program for the last 30 years, with millions of users in 25 languages offered. It's also available on desktop or as an app, so you can learn anytime, anywhere, and it uses an immersive experience to help you learn the language of your choice quickly, along with the correct accent using its true accent speech recognition technology. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. And did I mention it's 50% off for life? Start the new year off with a resolution you can reach. There's no better time than right now to get started, and Barbell Medicine listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Head over to rosettastone.com/today and get 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Again, it's 50% off at rosettastone.com/today. This podcast is sponsored by Incogni. Anyone who's been on the internet knows that online privacy and data protection is a big problem. Every year, both the number and severity of personal data compromise goes up, and according to the 2022 Annual Data Breach Report by Identity Theft Resource Center, the number of victims has gone up by nearly 41.5% from 2021. In the U.S. in particular, there's a big problem where people search individual websites to create detailed personal profiles on millions of Americans and publish them online for anyone to see. The bad news is that your personal information is probably being sold or published online without you even knowing it. The good news is you have the right to protect your privacy and request that data brokers delete the information that they hold about you. Let Incogni do the work for you. Incogni reaches out to data brokers on your behalf, requests your personal data removal, and deals with any objections from their side. It's easy to sign up, and once you do, the entire process is automated. Incogni also keeps you updated about the progress. They're also offering Barbell Medicine listeners a promotional rate to get started. Use promo code Barbell at the link incogni.com/barbell to get an exclusive 60% off an annual plan. That's incogni.com/barbell to get 60% off your annual plan to protect your privacy. Go incognito with Incogni.
Between client meetings, managing your business, and everyday tasks, who has time to worry about website hosting? With Kinsta's managed WordPress hosting, you don't have to. They handle the technical stuff, delivering lightning-fast load times, enterprise-grade security, and 24/7, 365 human-only support. Simply switching to Kinsta could make your site up to 200% faster. Kinsta's custom dashboard makes managing sites easy, with powerful features designed to save you time and effort. Plus, their free expert-led migrations ensure a smooth transition. Ready to see why Kinsta is trusted by thousands of businesses? Get your first month free at kinsta.com. That's KINSTA.com. Kinsta, simply better hosting.
Next sort of debate question here on Great Debates in Fitness and Health, episode 10. This one is, again, topical. This just happened. At the start of this new year, 2025, the United States Surgeon General, Dr. Vivek Murthy, released a new advisory on alcohol and cancer risk, stating that alcohol consumption is the third leading preventable cause of cancer in the U.S. after tobacco and obesity. Now, Dr. Murthy said, alcohol is a well-established preventable cause of cancer, responsible for about 100,000 cases of cancer and 20,000 cancer deaths annually in the United States, greater than the 13,500 alcohol-associated traffic crash fatalities per year in the United States. Yet, the majority of Americans are unaware of this risk. Now, recent survey data indicates that about half of Americans have used alcohol at least once in the last month, while about a quarter reported binge drinking, meaning they've had five or more drinks in one setting, and 6.5% reported drinking more than this. The current 2020 to 2025 dietary guidelines suggest that drinking less alcohol is better for health than drinking more, and individuals who do not drink alcohol should not start drinking for any reason. For those who do drink, the guidelines further recommend drinking two or less standard drinks per day for men and one drink or less daily for women, though they noted that emerging evidence suggests that even drinking within the recommended limits may increase the overall risk of death from various causes, such as from several types of cancer and some forms of cardiovascular disease. Therefore, caution is recommended. For the listeners at home, a standard drink in the U.S. is about 14 to 15 grams of alcohol. That's about a 12-ounce beer, 5 ounces of wine, or 1.5 ounces of an 80-proof spirit. So the premise, Dr. Baraki, you'll lead on this one, any amount of alcohol intake is bad for health. What say you?
Man, these broad premises are challenging. So I will I'll go ahead and take the affirmative on this. Let's see what happens.
All right.
The first thing is health, how we're defining that here. And I think that it is, if given the premise, how broad it is, fine to take as broad of a definition of health, comprising all of the usual domains, the biological domain, the psychosocial domain as well. And I think that if we look purely from a biological standpoint, I am not aware of compelling evidence direct biological benefit from ingesting alcohol. This has been purported before as far as its relationship with cardiovascular disease and some other things. That's not as convincing to me as maybe it might have appeared in prior years to other folks. And so there's not a biological endpoint or a biological outcome that I think is likely to be significantly improved through the regular ingestion of alcohol. As far as the psychosocial side, here is where you can probably make cases going in either direction. There are certainly those who feel that their psychosocial, health is maybe improved, maybe in social situations, interacting with others, community, things like that, that they might find enjoyable, positive for their mental health. I'm willing to concede that there are some people who might feel that way. That may or may not actually be accurate, but they might make that claim. And then there are also a great deal of people who, from a psychosocial standpoint, are severely harmed through the use of alcohol. And again, this is where I have to, at least in part, check my patient bias, because as far as my hospital work, I see an enormous amount of alcohol misuse and the harms of alcohol use disorders. I see, people in their 30s who have already developed advanced decompensated cirrhosis, who are unfortunately dying in their 30s and 40s because they are too ill to even qualify for a liver transplant or various other things. So I see the worst of the worst cases of alcohol related complications. in my work. But even setting that aside, I think there's probably some population from a psychosocial standpoint who feels they benefit and maybe do benefit. There's probably some who feel they benefit and maybe don't benefit as much as they think, or they don't actually benefit. And there's some who are like very clearly harmed. And so overall, a lack of direct biological benefit that I'm aware of on any, you know, significant outcome there. And then on balance, the psychosocial benefit might be neutral, might be slightly negative, might be slightly positive. I'm not aware of like great data that can really confidently answer this question. And so I'm going to lean towards the negative in that most people, broadly speaking, would benefit from drinking less than drinking more, which I think is a reasonable position to take on this. And I think that that group that is likely to benefit by drinking less than drinking more is, I'm more confident saying that that outweighs the group of people who, even in that maybe small psychosocial benefit group, are likely to benefit. So I think the former outweighs the latter. So I think that's where I'll put my stake down to start out on this question.
Yeah, I'd like to draw the listener's attention to the fact that Austin was mostly talking about reducing alcohol intake for people who were likely drinking above the recommendations, and not necessarily saying, he never said that any alcohol is likely to be harmful to health. But that's fine. We'll say that you gave the affirmative. So I'm forced to push back and, all right, well, let's see what I have here. I will concede that for some individuals, no level of alcohol consumption can reliably be regarded as safe. So individuals who are pregnant, people with personal or strong family history of alcohol use disorder, or people with alcohol-associated liver disease, other conditions, maybe like esophagitis comes to mind, for example. But when it comes to the rest of individuals, I think that this question is not only contentious because of like social conditioning, but also because the data itself is complicated. We have no long-term randomized trials of alcohol administration. They just don't exist. And then people who don't drink, so that's the comparator group, are different than people who do drink in more ways than just how much alcohol do they consume. So for example, some people stop drinking because of a chronic illness that has come about. Some people previously had a substance use disorder and now don't drink. And so no, those are abstainers. Abstention from alcohol is also an indicator in some individuals of underlying emotional or physical problems, certainly could be. And there are other lifestyle factors that can be different between people who don't drink alcohol at all and some people who drink a light or moderate amount. I will agree with you that the data on various outcomes, whether it's heart disease, quality of life, even cancer, that's what the Surgeon General's report is about, are not great when it comes to showing a benefit from alcohol. But I would push back and say there's some data that makes this interesting, at least to discuss. For example, the most common cause of death, we talk about just mortality here is in many countries is cardiovascular disease, right? And so the potential benefit of alcohol use needs to be weighed against the risks of alcohol consumption and the potential benefits. And so what are those potential benefits? There are multiple data sets showing that light to moderate alcohol consumption reduces some risk of cardiovascular events. But there's also some dissimilarity that like, oh, it can reduce the risk of heart attacks, but it does increase the risk of other bad outcomes. There's data from this United Kingdom cohort, close to 2 million adults who previously didn't have any signs of cardiovascular disease. And at a median follow-up of 6 years, not drinking compared with moderate drinking was associated with an increased risk of cardiovascular disease. So like unstable angina, heart attack, coronary heart disease, heart failure, ischemic stroke, and peripheral artery disease. It doesn't mean this data is like rock solid, but there's some signal there. Also the French paradox you kind of talked about, alluded to that earlier, you know, this idea that coronary heart disease mortality is lower in France than would be expected from the high national prevalence of smoking and saturated fat intake. And this is frequently attributed to like red wine consumption. There's complications in that data set. It's not awesome. But what I'm getting at is that there's at least some signal here that maybe warrants a more in-depth discussion than saying all alcohol is bad for everyone all the time in any amount. And it's like, again, how do you define health, right? Some folks, there's like a social benefit. So you could lump that under quality of life. So some people would report maybe an improved quality of life with some alcohol use, even if it took a little bit of time off their total lifespan. So adding life to your years, not years to your life, for example. There's some data showing that. In mortality, there's also a signal that some people who drink a light to moderate amount compared to abstainers, again, recognizing that people who don't drink, they're not a homogenous sort of sample. There are differences more than just the amount of alcohol they drink. There's some signal there that mortality may be decreased in those who drink a small amount regularly. With respect to cancer, I think the data is a little more clear that, like, in general, alcohol does not reduce the risk of most types of cancer outside of, like, confounding variables that are associated with people who drink a light to moderate amount. They tend to be different, again, than abstainers. And then the last point, and I suspect that you'll address this in the rebuttal, if you truly believed that any amount of alcohol intake was going to be harmful to your health, I suspect that you would have stopped drinking any alcohol a long time ago. Yet that is not the case, and I predict it's not going to be the case in the next decade to two decades going forward. You'll still enjoy a cocktail here and there, you know, drink responsibly, as it were. And so I believe that from a public health messaging standpoint, yeah, if you want to say most people should reduce the amount of alcohol that they drink, fine. Public health messaging, I'm signed off on that. But I don't believe in my heart of hearts that you truly agree with the premise that any alcohol is harmful to anyone at any amount. Otherwise, I believe your behaviors would reflect a different sort of set of values.
Yeah, I mean, there's a big assumption there that all humans behave purely rationally. And that's like a very optimizer biohacking type mindset. And we tend to see that in those optimizers is they tend to be much more, militant about anti-alcohol type of positions. And so, you know, from the premise, again, it was very broad. And if the premise is like, if you consume N-ethanol, like one ETOH molecule enters you, that you will be materially harmed. If we take the premise to that kind of extreme, then yeah, there's, you know, that's like a, that becomes a dose makes the poison type of thing. And so, yeah, I would not be inclined to agree with something to that level. You know, even though I don't have a ton of an enormous evidence base to base this on, my gut is that the standard recommendations of like two drinks a day for men, I do not love that recommendation. I do not think that that is great or advisable. You know, if I could get somebody who drinks much more than that down to that, I'm like, okay, I guess I'll count that as a win. But I still don't love somebody having two standard drinks every single day. I think that, you know, you and I probably have anywhere from like maybe 0 to 4 drinks in a given week or something like that on average. And we do that in the context of pretty good health in other ways, as well as usually in some kind of social context that we feel we're deriving some enjoyment or benefit out of or something like that, with essentially no intake at much higher levels, no binge, no consequences, legal, physical, or otherwise, as a result of it, that would lead to a diagnosis of like problematic use. And so, you know, obviously at the extreme of high levels of intake, for sure, severe harm. I see it every day at work. At the other extreme of like an ethanol molecule, yeah, no, I'm not gonna make the claim that that's bad for health. Even within guideline recommended ranges, I think that, you know, if somebody were saying I'm just meeting the guidelines and I'm having two drinks a day every day, long term, I think that that's probably more negative than helpful for most people. And then at even more modest, I think that it becomes more of an individual decision of like how much benefit do you feel you're deriving out of this, because I remain a bit skeptical of the cardiovascular data in general. And I think that I would lean more on like is the psychosocial benefit you're getting out of this, you know, worthwhile to you out, you know, compared with any potential downsides. There are essentially no situations where I, like, of the say 0 to 4 drinks in a given week that I might have, where I'm just like sitting in a chair by myself at home having that. That is not the context for either of us, I imagine. It's usually in a different type of situation where we, you know, are enjoying it in other ways, recognizing that like, hey, this is not like the elixir of health. But you know, it is what it is. We're not optimizers in that way either.
No. Yeah. Okay. This is an interesting thing because, yeah, again, my father came over to my place before he had his knee replacement. This is maybe a month ago. And he's like, why do you have all this liquor here? Like, I do. I have bottles of bourbon, you know, predominantly, just a lot of them. And it's not because I you know, just sit at home and make pours, you know, on a regular basis or make cocktails, or whatever. I have acquired these either from friends or I purchased them myself. And I won't drink by myself because I'm just not going to be sitting around the house. I just don't. It's not my preference. It's going to be a social setting. However, allow and entertain me on this one. Okay. What is, you know, if we think about like an area under the curve for fun on a given evening. Okay. So let's say you're planning on going out, you're having dinner with friends, meeting friends for a drink, something like that. Just think about the area under the curve of fun, the average amount of fun. How do we optimize that? We're biohacking fun here. Okay.
Oh my God.
so think about, we can separate the night into three separate like areas. Okay. And let's just go through them. So one is like getting ready. You got to take a shower. You got to shave. You got to, you know, put some clothes on or whatever. Fun level is low. Right. Then second part, you're with your friends, you're socializing, having a good time. Fun level is high. And then the third part, you're going home. You're in an Uber or whatever. You're going home, not with friends anymore. Presumably fun level is lower. So if alcohol was really this like fun inducing agent, so to speak, you would be optimized if you drank while you were getting ready maybe, and then had like a nightcap on the way home, and then you didn't have anything with your friends. Your area under the curve would go up, more fun. How does that strike you?
This strikes me as a psychotic way of examining social interaction. I think that's my conclusion.
Yeah, all right, fair enough. Maybe we'll try that. No RCT on different intervals for alcohol consumption. All right, let's move on to the next question here on Great Debates number 10. We're going to talk about muscle gain. Now, people work out for many reasons, like improving their general health and body composition. However, one of the most popular reasons for working out is to gain muscle for either sport or even just aesthetics. Now, as an adult, gaining significant amounts of muscle typically requires resistance training alongside good nutrition to support recovery and muscle growth. Over the years, there have been many different dietary approaches recommended for muscle gain. For example, some recommend eating at maintenance, which is a diet consisting of enough calories to maintain, but not gain or lose any weight, while others recommend eating a large calorie surplus in order to pile on slabs of muscle. The premise, which I'll lead off on, is eating at maintenance equivalent to eating a large surplus for long-term muscle gain? And I will take the negative that eating at maintenance is not equivalent to eating at a large surplus at various times for long-term muscle gain. Now, I know I added that at various times because I think just due to the umbrella nature of this premise, I can kind of clarify things. And a large calorie surplus by definition would be enough to produce greater than 3 to 4 kilograms of weight gain per month. There's this whole idea that, okay, you can just quote main gain your way to like this Adonis type physique, right? And so that recommendation would again be, hey, eat at maintenance so you're not actually gaining weight or losing weight. And if you keep training, you know, with a good program and you do that for a long period of time, you will reach your maximum muscular potential as a natural sort of individual. And the other people would argue, well, now you got to go through periods of like bulking and cutting and maintaining to otherwise sort of max out your potential. And the way I think about this is how I think about most other sort of human responses to various interventions. This kind of happens on a bell curve. You're going to have some folks who, if they did eat at maintenance, you know, in perpetuity, they would gain a large amount of muscle mass. Their body weight wouldn't change that much, but they would gain a relatively large amount of muscle mass. They just respond super well to this sort of stuff. You have other people who would not gain much muscle at all, and then everybody else is in between. Same thing in response to a large surplus. Some people will gain a ton of muscle, right? A lot more than maintenance. Some people will gain a little bit more than maintenance and other people will gain about the same, just not set up to gain a large proportional amount of muscle. I think for most folks, however, that maintaining their weight in perpetuity is going to limit their ability to gain muscle mass. If you want to get close to your genetic ceiling, your genetic potential, your, you know, skeletal frames, muscle mass carrying capacity, I suspect that most people will have to gain weight, full stop. And in order to gain weight, full stop, you'll have to be in a surplus. The question then becomes, does it need to be a large surplus for periods of time, or should it be a smaller surplus for a longer period of time? To me, that's all about individual level responses. And so I can't confidently say that there's one superior strategy for all folks. The way I would sort of operationalize this would be to generally recommend a relatively small surplus, something like plus 200 to plus 500 calories a day to start, and see how you do. As you go along and gauge your response, you may have to kick that up a little bit. Now, whether that's due to adherence issues, whether it's due to sort of metabolic adaptation, whether that's due to other sort of unique factors, I can't be certain. All of those things could potentially contribute. But I think most people will have to do a dedicated like bulking cycle, or and likely multiple many of them over the course of their training career to maximize the amount of muscle mass that they can put on their frame. It seems highly unlikely to me that you could just main gain your way to the maximum sort of muscle carrying capacity for your skeleton. Austin, what do you think?
I know that this might be disappointing from like the content standpoint, but I don't really think that this is debatable. Can I just concede right off the bat?
Well, I guess, yeah, you can, but then I'm going to make you talk about why do you think this idea sort of exists where people will continue to promote maintaining? Is this a nomenclature thing where people are saying, look, when I say maintenance, I don't actually mean that you can't gain any weight, for example. What I mean is actually a small surplus, and I'm calling that maintenance. Like, if that's the case, it's just a language thing, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think if the claim is that you can be truly at maintenance and, like, get as much muscle mass as you can over the long period of time, it's just a nonsensical claim. Like, I don't even think that, you know, as much as we like to rely on evidence to support our claims, like, that just feels like something that can be dismissed almost out of hand because it's incompatible with, like, physiologic kind of principles. The idea would be that you would, like, selectively waste away a bunch of, I don't know, adipose and other, like, non-muscle mass and replace that with muscle mass up to the same level that you would have otherwise gotten if you were in a surplus, which is just completely nonsensical. I think that most of the time what they're talking about is, yeah, a much slower, steadier kind of rate of weight gain via a small surplus compared with proper bulking and cutting type cycles. And I think that that comes from a variety of places, both a combination of personal preference, as well as for some folks who promote this, just like a mortal fear of fat gain, sometimes verging on, you know, disordered type eating or what has been termed this kind of orthorexia and things like that, which are not super well defined, but that's where I suspect this comes from. And I think that if somebody, I think that most people, myself included, who, you know, I do not go through dedicated bulking and cutting cycles. I unintentionally cut because of life getting in the way, work and stress and sleep and illness and things like that, but never deliberately. And it's just been more of a slow, steady kind of process from the time when I started training. But I've fully recognized that, like, am I actually getting to the maximum amount of muscle mass that my skeletal frame can carry? No, but that's also never been my objective. If it had been, then I would have gone about my entire training career very, very, very differently. I would have not ever pulled the one rep maxes that I had because I'd be training just towards a completely different end goal. So yeah, if it is actually maintenance as defined by, you know, energy balance, no, nonsensical claim. If it is a small surplus, okay, but then the terminology is inaccurate and it comes more from a world of fear of fat gain and maybe not wanting to go through the inconvenience of bulking and cutting because you don't want to eat till you're sick and then you don't want to have to go through a dieting phase, which I'll raise my hand and say I'm one of those people who does not care to go through that process because it's just not that important of an outcome to me.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a little bit of evidence out there suggesting that greater surpluses definitely seem to increase the amount of muscle mass that people gain over a given period of time. They also tend to gain more fat mass as well. Now, where the inflection point lies between like a very small surplus to like a very large one, like where you maximize sort of muscle gain, that again is more speculation and it's likely to vary between individuals. And the idea that you could regulate your calorie intake that tightly over a long period of time, it seems highly suspect to me. So if I was trying to gain as much muscle mass as possible, I'd probably err higher than that, you know, mythical inflection point and accept a little bit more fat gain, understanding that I'm going to have to go through a period of cutting or dieting later in order to reduce body fat. If, again, that's my goal. If I'm not concerned with like the rapidity of muscle gain, like how fast it happens, you could make an argument that a small surplus, like if you keep chugging away, you're going to get there. It's just going to take longer. And so there's some sort of like opportunity cost here. Like, why are you gaining muscle in the first place? If it's for competitive purposes, right? You're like, I want to be the best powerlifter. I want to be the best bodybuilder. I want to be the best, whatever, strength athlete. And we believe that there's a good, you know, correlation between muscle mass, cross-sectional area size and muscle mass and strength, all that is tied together. Then you could make a case, well, hey, maybe it is better to gain it a little bit faster. I still don't think that like a dirty bulk or quick bulk is generally advisable for most individuals just due to the risks of carrying excess body fat. And the longer that goes on, well, the worse it seems to be. So yeah, it's a kind of a mythical question. Like, what is the optimal amount of surplus? And like, again, the idea that this wouldn't vary significantly between individuals just seems silly to me. So it's like, hey, what is the best amount of training volume? What's the optimal training volume? Yeah. It's like, well, it depends.
Yeah, you know? A lot of things.
Totally. All right, last question. Another one of your favorite topics. You get to lead off on this one. We're going to talk about drugs, but not the drugs that you typically prescribe, the drugs that some athletes and other recreational individuals tend to use. We're talking about PEDs, performance-enhancing drugs. Now, PED use in sports has been going on ever since sports were created. For example, it is reported that in the Olympic Games in 668 BC, athletes consumed a diet of dried figs to improve running performance. Ancient Greeks used brandy and wine, and Roman gladiators used stimulants, including coca leaves and muscarin-containing mushrooms. All told, PED use is not a modern phenomenon. While accurate data is difficult to come by, most estimates suggest PEDs are widely used in sport. For example, 29% of participants in the 2011 Track and Field World Championships admitted to use of PEDs, as did 45% at the 2011 Pan Arab Games. A 2012 survey found that about 12% of athletes would dope if it were illegal, but there were no consequences, and 5% that they would dope if it were legal and it would guarantee them an Olympic gold medal, but it would also mean that they would die within 5 years. Even in non-competitive athletes, PED use is common, with some survey data showing that about three quarters of men in the gym have used anabolic steroids, typically at relatively high doses. In a review of 500 anonymous anabolic androgenic steroid users, 78% of whom were non-competitive bodybuilders, so non-athletes, almost 60% reported administering at least 1,000 milligrams of testosterone or its equivalent per week. That's about five times the TRT dose, so it's not TRT if you're on 1,000 milligrams of test per week. And 25% admitted that they were also using human growth hormone and insulin for anabolic effects. Wonder where that survey data came from. Like, what gym is that? Not surprisingly, about 99% of this survey population reported side effects from anabolic androgenic steroid use. It appears that PED use may be increasing, not only in sport, but also in teens. The Partnership Attitude Tracking Study, the PATS study, found that in 2013, 11% of teens reported using synthetic human growth hormone within their lifetime, which is a twofold increase since 2012. That's 1 year. While steroid use increased from 5% to 7% in the same time frame. So the premise is it ethical to use performance-enhancing drugs in professional sports? Ethics, of course, having this sort of moral sort of designation. And just for the listeners at home, I believe my colleague and certainly myself will sort of invoke this WADA sort of principle for, you know, what makes a prohibited substance, what makes it a PED. And so they use these three criteria. It has the potential to enhance sport performance. It represents an actual or potential health risk to the athlete, and it violates the spirit of the sport. So basically two out of three, and you can end up on the prohibited substance list. So Austin, is it ethical to use PEDs in professional sports?
Yeah, so up front, I am not an ethicist or a philosopher or an expert in these types of questions, but just go on what my gut says here. And I'm going to say, no, it is not ethical. And I'm going to come at this with two primary points. One is pretty straightforward in that WADA criteria, that idea of the spirit of sport, which is admittedly a nebulous kind of concept, but I think it's one of those that most people have a general understanding of what is meant by it.
Know it when they see it.
Yeah, exactly. But I'm going to tie back to one of my prior answers in the sumo deadlift question, right? And it has to do with the objectives of sport. Does it matter what the outcome is, or does how you got there kind of matter? And that itself also relates to this concept of the spirit of sport, right? Because you can have a sport where it says, all right, so if you want to compete in this event, show up this day, this time, this platform, pick up as much weight as you possibly can. I do not care what you do to get here. Whoever picks up the most weight wins. Done. In such a sport as defined in that way, go for it. Use all the drugs. Do whatever you want, right? Because it was just defined as pick up the most weight anyhow, right? Technique, drugs, what, like, I don't know, some smart person is going to find the loophole and just show up with like a forklift and be like, well, you know, the rules didn't say so I win within the rules of the sport, right? But when we talk about spirit of sport here, I think a lot of it relates to testing you know, people testing themselves against one another in terms of the genetic allotment that they have received, and then the training and guidance and competitive mindset and various other things that happen in the heat of sport, and who comes out on top in that environment without the use of something like PEDs. And again, this is not not a familiar area for us to be navigating in that it is a lot of it's really nebulous. A lot of it is just kind of these moral judgments that we're putting on these things. But again, I don't have a strong moral judgment against these things in general, outside of this concept of, is the sport as defined just like do whatever it takes to accomplish this outcome, right? Which is the idea behind what I've heard are these like enhanced games that are going to happen, where it's people are just like, you know, do the thing, don't care what you do to get there. Okay, like then the full expectation is you will pull every possible lever, take every risk, do every drug, and then if you come out on top, then you are the person who, you know, not only trained the hardest, had the best genetics, had the best drugs, was the least likely to die from side effects of these drugs, et cetera, compared with the broader world of sport that I don't think carries that implication, or most people do not expect that as part of it in terms of what they view as the spirit of sport for these other things. Admittedly, nebulous concepts, but I think that that's what most people think of when they talk about sport and what they expect of it.
Yeah, no, a very reasoned response. I'm inclined to give you kudos for that. I don't find myself disagreeing with you per se. However, my interpretation of the current landscape in athletics is such that the sports themselves almost mandate PED use for many of these very popular sports. And there are a lot of popular stories kind of supporting that. So for example, you look at Ben Johnson and Charlie Francis, and Charlie Francis was his coach. Ben Johnson he ran a 9.88 in the 1988 Olympics in Seoul, for example, and got popped for Winstrol. Even though it was funny, he's like, I wasn't taking that drug. I was taking drugs, of course, but like I wasn't taking that particular agent. Somebody spiked my sample. And his coach said as much. He's like, look, this is what we would typically run. And it was never Winstrol because that made him tight and slow. Their claim was that the speeds that they needed to run in order to basically participate in the sport were not attainable naturally. And their evidence for that was that look at the rate of improvement. Okay, thing one, which is not consistent with like the natural evolution of sport. And then two, look at all the other people that got popped as well. Of that final race in 1988, 7 of the 8 finalists were popped. Like their sample eventually tested positive, right? You torture the data long enough, you find something, find better ways to test. And so their thing was like, look, if you want to be a high level track and field athlete, well, you got to practice all the time. You need to be a professional athlete. And the only way to do that is from this like sort of state sponsored, in this case, that was Canada, sponsoring the, you know, they put them up in lodging, they pay for their life, et cetera. And the only way to qualify for that, you had to run fast enough to like meet that threshold. And the only way to do that was with drugs. And I think that's applicable to many other sports that you see PED use. It's been normalized within the sport. Tour de France, same sort of thing. And so when I think about like the moral judgment, I think this mostly comes from people outside of sport, because drugs, particularly anabolic steroids and these PEDs, is umbrella term, have been stigmatized. And you know, I'm not going to speak to that. We can't walk that back. I say we, the royal we here. But I do think that like, if the level of performance is so high that people can't get there naturally, or not enough people to constitute a real sport can get there naturally, man, it makes a case. It's like, well, then what do you have to do to participate? Now, there are knock-on effects to that, certainly, right? If this is the level of performance that people are aiming for or shooting for, like, look, maybe that encourages kids to take risks they otherwise shouldn't be taking. But I don't know how you fix that, because our testing policies and procedures, you know, in most sports, whether it's their WADA, whether it's some other sort of organization that does the testing, they're not good at finding people who are using, and they don't, you know, disincentivize people from using either. They're like, well, look, sometimes you get popped and sometimes you won't. And if you do get popped, look, here are the consequences, and people keep using regardless. We don't have enough punishment, I guess you could make the case like, oh, do you get the death penalty, right? You get popped, death, you can never participate in sport again. Maybe that would lower the use. So when I think about this, I'm not trying to make excuses for people that do use PEDs and it's against the rules. I mean, very clearly, you would say, look, just participate by the rules of the game. If everyone agrees on the rules, that's how you got to play. It's just that because of almost institutionalized PED use, I don't know that we should have a moral judgment against people that are using this in professional sports. And you could go further down the rabbit hole and say, well, look, like some people have uneven, unequal, unfair sort of opportunities earlier in life, better coaches, better access to participate in sport, all sorts of stuff, better training programs. And so does this level the playing field, right? In this weird sort of utopian world where everybody finishes the race the exact same time? Is that the outcome that you want? I don't know. So I think when it comes to, you know, the ethics of this, I have no real moral judgment about people that use. I almost feel sorry for folks that have gotten, I sympathize with them when they get popped. I'm like, look, I get it. Like I can make a rational sort of argument for why you did what you did. And now you're going to suffer some consequences that may be unfairly because you were the only one that got popped and a lot of other people should have too. So yeah, that's my little pushback here. I just think that the current state of sport, many sports anyway, sort of require the use of PEDs for most folks to participate. And if the goal of sport is to get everyone to participate, that's part in the Olympic Charter, you know, give everybody an opportunity to participate, you know, it gets kind of dicey there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't, there's not going to be one correct answer to come down on here, but definitely, you know, those who do, end up testing positive, you're right that you can see it's like their mentality was like, well, this is the only way that I can hang with the best because all the other best are also doing this too. And so there's not a realistic way to just like wipe this out of all sport, even if we wanted to. And so that's why we're left just kind of hand waving around things like morality and ethics.
And spirit of sport. Yeah.
Yeah. Spirit of sport, whatever that is, despite the fact that there's relatively little that we can practically do to like eliminate this or control it in a very effective way.
Yeah. I think if, you know, this all came down to like the health of the athletes, for example, and you took a realistic look again at the current landscape, you would say, look, people are going to use a number of different agents, regardless if we ban them or not. And if we really want to like improve the health and prevent bad outcomes, maybe there would be some sort of harm reduction approach where you're like, look, we're going to allow X, Y, and Z at various levels. And if you want to take that, fine. And if you don't, also fine. We're going to monitor people, you know, and you're going to have access to trained physicians who are trained in this stuff, which don't currently exist by and large. So I don't know. It's a wicked problem. Like as Pelkey would describe, like we don't know there's not great evidence here. We don't know even the right questions to ask. And we're kind of forced to make policies that may hamstring us in the future. So it's tough. I don't know. I'm trying to think of like a recent sort of doping scandal and none come to mind. Although I was getting my haircut this past week and my barber was like, hey, did you hear about the LeBron EPO thing? And effectively, people were accusing him of using erythropoietin, you know, presumably to increase his conditioning via expanded, you know, red blood cell mass and such. And I was like, I mean, I would be surprised if he wasn't on stuff at this particular point. I would also be surprised if the NBA's Player Association didn't have some sort of protections in place for if one of their stars were to pop, right? I mean, there are bargaining agreements. There's all sorts of different policies in place of different sports. And so I suspect that the general public is under the false pretenses that most athletes at the highest level have never used or are not using. And I do not believe that to be the case. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it's different when you're in the world of such a big business as like NBA and the entire market that it has, or any of the, you know, big major American sports, for example. I think it's fundamentally different compared with, you know, Olympic like weightlifting, where not big business, not a big, you know, it's like traditional Eastern European sport, right?
Yeah,
that
yeah.
is breaking into other areas. But just the sheer incentives that are at play at a sport at that, you know, at that level, I think that does change some of the dynamic and does lead to, you know, some of this potentially conspiratorial thinking about what's going on behind the scenes.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. You know, when I say the majority, I guess I would maybe walk that back and say, I don't know that if it's greater than 50%, right?
Sure.
That'd be a bold claim, but it's probably more than what most people think.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, all the statistics that you cited in the intro to this premise was probably greater than people think. Those are some high percentages at some of those big games.
Yeah. Can you imagine, like, you're a teenager and you're using growth hormone? Like,
absolutely.
What? What? Like, one, that's expensive. Yeah. Like, because you're not being prescribed it for, like, you know, achondroplasia or something like that. So you're getting it from Vinny, and Vinny's, you know, marking it up. So, yeah, interesting. All right. Well, hey, that is a wrap here on Great Debates in Fitness and Health, Episode 10. Special shout out to Dr. Austin Baraki for spending time with us. Before you guys go anywhere, though, leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. From everyone here at Barbell Medicine, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. We'll catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast. Hey everyone, Jordan here from Barbell Medicine. Now we'll get to the podcast here in just a moment, but I wanted to take a second to plug our Barbell Medicine Plus option in order to help support what we do here on the podcast and beyond. Now, if you hate these ads just as much as we do, you should know that Plus members get ad-free episodes, as well as early access to our podcast, written episode summaries, videos, exclusive training information, access to a members-only podcast where Dr. Baraki and I answer your questions directly, and more exclusive content as well. If you want to support what we're doing here and become a Barbell Medicine Plus member, head over to barbellmedicine.com/plus and sign up to be a Plus member today. That's barbellmedicine.com/plus to help us out and get rid of these ads for good. Thanks for your support. Let's head to the podcast.
Hey, football fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win up to $250,000 in bonus bets. It's all part of BetMGM's longest touchdown jackpot, where you'll be able to split the grand prize with anyone else who bet on the longest touchdown of the week. Log into your BetMGM account today and opt into the promo. Then, place an anytime touchdown wager of $10 or more on the player of your choice up to one player per game. If your player scores the longest touchdown of the week, you'll win a share of the $250,000. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This U.S. promotional offer is not available in Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. For New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369. For Arizona, 1-800-NEXT-STEP. For Massachusetts, 1-800-327-5050. For Iowa, 1-800-BETS-OFF. For Puerto Rico, 1-800-981-0023. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are unrestricted bonus dollars that expire in 7 days. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.